It's 6:59 and 37 seconds here at KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, K201 HR 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, and our listener-supported Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, and we're also on the web at kzyx.org. Good evening, everyone. We've just heard the California Report and the evening news here at KZYX and Z, and we're getting ready for Education Now. So, here we go. Well, we had a very short music there because we have a long broadcast tonight. Tonight on Education Now, I want you to invite you to join me for this rebroadcast of The Children of Immigration with Professor of Globalization and Education, Marcelo Zuara-Zarzalco of New York University. He and his wife, Corolla, wrote the book Children of Immigration, and I had him on the show with a live broadcast on January 15th here on Education Now, but our transmitters were down so that only those that were listening online heard the show. And it's just a wonderful show, and I really want to share it with all of you. But it's kind of a rough start, but here we go. And remember, it's a live broadcast, so you're going back into the future, January 15th, 2009. And I just welcome Marcelo, and I wish Corolla could join us. I know that Marcelo told me that Corolla's brother lived in Mendocino County for some years and that they just love Mendocino County, and of course we love Mendocino County as well. Well, tonight's show is just going to be wonderful. I can't tell you how impressive this book is, and I can't tell you how impressed I am with the other things that Marcelo and Corolla have done. Their new book, Learning a New Land, Immigrant Students in American Society, is a 2007 Virginia and Warren Stone Prize awarded annually by Harvard University Press for an outstanding book on education and society. One child in five in America is the child of immigrants, and their numbers increase each year. Very few will return to the country they barely remember. Who are they, and what America do they know? Based on an extraordinary interdisciplinary study that followed 400 newly arrived children from the Caribbean, China, Central America, and Mexico for 5 years, this book provides a compelling account of the lives, dreams, and frustrations of these youngest immigrants. Richly told portraits of high and low achievers are packed with unexpected ironies. When they arrive, most children are full of optimism and a respect for education, but poor neighborhoods and dull, often dangerous schools can corrode hopes. The vast majority learn English, but it is the English of video games and the neighborhood, not that of standardized tests. For some of these children, those heading off to college, America promises to be a land of dreams. These lucky ones have often benefited from caring mentors, supportive teachers, or savvy parents. For others, the first 5 years are marked by disappointments, frustrations, and disenchantments. How can we explain their varied academic journeys? The children of immigrants, here to stay, are the future, and how they adapt will determine the nature of America in the 21st century. Well, are you there,
yes,
Marcelo?
Yes, I am. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Oh, thank you so much for saying yes. I just, you know, there are so many misconceptions that the majority of people have about children of immigrants and children who immigrate here. And I just found so much support for my own prejudices in your work and in the work that you and others have done.
Thank you. And I should say that we started a lot of this research in California, actually in Northern California, and where we, the headquarters of immigration studies then, was at the Berkeley campus of the University of California, where we worked with the immigrant families from Mexico. And then here in the East Coast, we worked with the families and the children from Asia, from China mostly, and the Caribbean region, children, families from Haiti and the Dominican Republic.
Yes, it's vast. What you have been managing to do is vast research, and it just needs to be out there. I don't see a lot of this out there in the press. Are you finding that it's difficult to get press?
Well, you know, it's very interesting, Athena. There is a great deal of press on the issue of immigration. There is a great debate on the economics of immigration, particularly in the context of the current economic crisis. Are immigrants good for the U.S. economy? Are they not good for the U.S. economy? Do immigrants hurt the wages of U.S. workers? Do they contribute to the overall economic well-being of the United States? But almost nothing in the major media, in the mainstream media, on the fundamental question of how immigrants, and most particularly their children, will be a major force reshaping the promise of our democracy. As you've indicated in your introduction, immigrant children now are the fastest growing sector of the U.S. child population. If you look at our biggest cities in the United States, if you look at New York City, half of the children in New York City schools today come from immigrant homes. 70% of the children in Los Angeles, California today come from Latino, the vast majority of them immigrant origin youth. So this is a fundamental issue reshaping our country, especially in a handful of states. If you take California, New York, Florida, Texas, Illinois, these are the states that are going to be profoundly affected by how the children of today's immigrants adapt and how they manage their pathways into our democracy, into the labor market, into citizenship, and really rewriting the story of belonging and inclusion in our society.
Yes, I hear you. And one of the things that was really striking to me in the book Children of Immigration was the diversity issue, how we have huge numbers of immigrants into America. And yet when they come here, they lose their culture and they lose their language. And so diversity, as a person who biologically I favor diversity, and I know that is the best way, and yet we're destroying diversity in the kind of education, in the way that we've been doing it. Is that right?
Well, that's the great paradox, Athena, that immigrants to our country today are more diverse than ever before. In any one of our 50 states, in any major city today, in middle-sized cities, in smaller cities, in urban and suburban areas, even in rural America today, what we're seeing is an increasing diversification of our immigrant origin population. In the large cities today, it's very common to see and to find and to hear children from literally, in some cases, over 150 different countries. Never before in the history of our country have we seen so much human diversity in terms of origins, in terms of languages, in terms of race, in terms of ethnicity, in terms of religion. And that diversity is a profound boost to the fiber of our cultural democracy. Diversity adds to the cultural stock of the nation. It is what makes us stronger, because the U.S. is drawing talent, is drawing energy, is drawing optimism from literally all over the world. These are doctors from Ghana who were educated in Ghana at the expense of taxpayers in Ghana, who are now practicing in Westchester County, New York. These are computer scientists from India who moved to California and are now contributing to the development of the latest and, in many cases, most important technologies. They are the leading scientists. President Obama recently appointed the child of an immigrant as one of the key members of his cabinet, the professor who will, from the Lawrence Berkeley Lab, who will be heading our science and technology innovation moving forward. So this has been the strength of our nation, the children of immigrants, whether it's General Powell, the child of Caribbean immigrants to New York City, whether it's Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, and on we can go through the list of how much the children of immigrants have contributed to our economy, to our society, to our democracy. Also, unfortunately, we see that over time and across generations, much of this diversity tends to be dissipated, and the children of immigrants lose their home languages, they lose an understanding of the cultural traditions of their elders, and this creates tensions, this creates disappointments within the families and the communities, and that is something that I really think we need to think through as a nation.
I couldn't agree with you more. I myself am the child of first and second generation Greek people. My father was, came to this country as a 13-year-old, and my mother was whose parents immigrated here from Greece, and so I do understand, and I know the school experience, which is where I'd like to go now, is the school experience for these children, and I can't thank you enough for the article you sent me that was in the New York Times, January 10th, 2009, on the front page. Immigrants see charter schools as a haven. I just loved this, and I loved what you said. The good news is that immigrant kids are learning English better and faster than ever before in U.S. history. Yeah, that they're quoting you. But they're assimilating to a society that parents see as very threatening and frightening. It's anti-authority, anti-studying, it's materialistic. And you talk about, you say, one of the primary reasons that American society, this is a quote by a person named Diane Ravitch, she, in this article, she says, one of the primary reasons that American society supports public schools is to give everyone a solid civic education, the sort of education that comes from learning together with others from different backgrounds. But you counter and say, the reality is that most new immigrants become isolated in public schools and that large numbers of them become alienated over time and fail to graduate.
That's right. So this is a very crucial issue that we need to take on as a society, and I hope that this is very much an item high in the agenda of the new administration.
Yes, I know that it is.
And that is, how are we going to encourage the civic engagement of the immigrant origin population at a time when our schools are facing such tremendous problems, from funding to training of teachers to really getting our classrooms and our engagement of children to be in sync with the realities of a 21st century society and economy that are very, very different from the societies and economies that gave birth to the educational system as we understood it for most of the 20th century. The reality is that most schools in our country, and in many other countries, by the way, we're not alone here, are really, truly out of sync with the realities of a world that is changing much, much faster, that is more integrated, where an economic disaster in New York City immediately, instantaneously has repercussions all over the world. We live in a world in the 21st century where the integration of societies, the integration of economies, characterizes and drives this patterns of change, and our educational system is completely out of touch with these realities of the 21st century. That's why it's of fundamental importance that immigrant parents feel empowered, that they feel that their voice is respected, it's heard, and it's a fundamental part of how we create partnerships for educating children, immigrant and native alike, to thrive in the 21st century world in which they will live. Unfortunately, today, many immigrant origin parents, our research, the research of others, suggest, feel very, very alienated from the schools. They feel the schools don't respect them, don't reach out to them, don't value their worldviews, their ideals, their understandings of what they would like to be in partnership with the schools and see in terms of the future development of their children. This is an area where there is a tremendous amount of miscommunication and distance between the immigrant origin parents and our schools in really throughout our country. So this is an area where there's a tremendous opportunity to do some good work.
Yes, I agree with you, and I know that there are some charter schools in the Bay Area that are having tremendous success with Latino youth, and they've gotten a little tiny bit of press. Here's another quote that you, Marcelo, that you make in this article on charter schools. What these parents are doing is taking ownership of their children's schools is as American as apple pie. They're doing what soccer moms and dads in Lexington, Massachusetts, and Concord and Cambridge to do day in and day out. They're modeling for kids the story of acculturation and how it works.
That's correct. I think that those who worry that these charter schools for immigrant children, the story in the Times on Saturday was about the charter schools in Minnesota that have been organized around Hmong immigrant communities.
An international charter school.
Yeah, the international charter school. One is mostly with Hmong children. There's another one that has large numbers of African children, Somali children. I believe there's another one for Ethiopian children. And the question that concerns many observers is, are these schools fostering a kind of a separate identity? And I think that the article makes it clear that what the parents are really doing is they are performing for their children really a profoundly American story about engagement, about civic engagement, about citizenship. At a time when most teachers in most schools, we've done a great deal of research over the last three decades. We've interviewed teachers up and down Northern and Southern California, over here in the East Coast, since we've moved from first from the Bay Area to San Diego. Then we moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts, where we were in the faculty at Harvard for many years, and we just moved now to New York to head immigration studies at New York University. In all of these settings, we've interviewed parents, we've interviewed teachers, we've interviewed children, and the basic question that most teachers working with immigrant origin populations will bring up in the interviews is this idea that they find it difficult to communicate and to engage with the immigrant origin parents. So what these schools in Minnesota are doing is, at a time when teachers feel that parents are not sufficiently involved, these parents have taken a profound leadership in taking charge of their children's lives and education by developing these partnerships in the cities and developing these schools where the children feel much more comfortable, where there is much more engagement, where issues relating to gender, identity, economic, second language acquisition, and so on and so forth, have yielded very positive results. So I feel this as a, that this is a profoundly American lesson that these parents are teaching their children. What better lesson on civic engagement than to teach your children that you can take charge of your school, you can build a better school, and you can build a school that will have the promise of a better future for not only your children, but for all children. I think that's a wonderful example of what a cultural democracy can achieve.
I couldn't agree with you more. And that small is beautiful, as Schumacher would say. And these charter schools, that's the wonderful thing about them, is that parents have power in those charter schools. Teachers who believe in the kind of philosophy that they're using run these schools. And so it's win-win. And I just don't know why there's such resistance to the death of these huge mausoleums that are alienating. I mean, I knew from the late 70s the research was saying that these huge schools were alienating, and I just can't even imagine how alienating they would be to an immigrant, a student who couldn't speak English. I know that my oldest brother could not speak English when he started school, and he never recovered. Now, when I started school, I spoke some English. I was the youngest, and so did my brother, who was just older than I was. And we also had family there, so we could, you know, we had our own group, you might say. So we could combat the prejudice, really, is what it was. But he has never really recovered from that experience. And this is why, another reason why this issue is very, very close to me. That
I think also your story tells a larger story that we found in many, many immigrant origin families, and that is how gender plays a very powerful role in the adaptation of boys and girls. Overall, our research, the research of others, has demonstrated that immigrant origin girls, whether it's in the immigrant generation or in the second generation, tend to overall, across time and over the generations, do better academically than immigrant origin boys. This is an issue where the girls are more likely to learn English better, faster. The girls are more likely to remain academically engaged in ways that boys not always do. And if we have a series of specific concerns in regards to the adaptations of immigrant origin children, a great deal of these concerns have to do with the special issues that boys face in regards to their engagement with schooling and with developing the skills they're going to need to succeed in the United States in the 21st century.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, and I want to return to it. But first, I would like to identify, this is Education Now. I'm your host, Athena Melville, and we have Marcelo Suarez Orzoco on the phone with us, PhD, Professor of Globalization and Education and Co-Director of Immigration Studies at New York University. I'm sorry, he is the Courtney Sell Ross University Professor of Globalization and Education and Co-Director of Immigration Studies at New York University, co-director with his wife, Carola. And I just think what you were talking about, and this is KZYX radio here in Mendocino County that you're listening to. And well, let's get back now to this. What you're talking about now is the emotional and the psychological dimension, and that is really interesting. And you cover that so well in this book that I have just been unable to let go of. That emotional, that boys really are, have an emotional disadvantage. They are not as hardy as girls are. People are going to get upset with us that we're making distinctions based on sex. But it is true, more boys are labeled dyslexic. More boys are given Ritalin in school. More boys are die at birth. So boys just are emotionally not as hardy as girls are.
Well, certainly the data on what happens after immigration suggests that immigration tends to, in the long term, impose a penalty on young boys and men, more so than on girls or young women or women. Through the life cycle, the preponderance of evidence suggests that immigrants beginning during childhood and really throughout the life cycle, young women tend to have better mechanisms for adaptation. I think it's probably part of this relational psychology that we have come to understand, central for understanding the psychology of young women and women, that seems to inoculate immigrant origin young women and women to the adversities, and seems to facilitate their acquisition of English and the emergence of the particularly girls in the family as ambassadors, as spokespersons for the family. Over and over again in immigrant homes, we discovered a pattern by which it was the young girls who became the voice of the family in dealing with the government, in dealing with doctor's issues, in helping open a bank account. It's a very, very interesting pattern. The young women have more responsibilities. They are supposed to help out more. They are supposed to be present at these interactions with the outside world, whether it's the bank, with the government in terms of getting paperwork done, or in everyday interactions in stores, with the bureaucracy. It tends to be largely the girls and the young women in the family who are the ambassadors of the family. And one possibility here, Athena, is that these young immigrant girls, young women, are learning a lot of skills, a lot of competencies in assuming these responsibilities within the household and vis-a-vis the interactions of the household with the outside world, that tend to favor them over the kinds of skills and sensibilities that the young boys and young men are developing around masculinity, in some cases around machismo, in some cases around saving face, in some cases around keeping distance from other boys. So this is something that we have discovered, and I think it's part of a larger pattern. And this is very interesting. If you ask the families when they arrive, who would like to stay and who would like to perhaps return back to the old country one day, young women and women generally will tell you that they prefer to stay in the United States. The men, on the other hand, particularly the older men, are much, much more likely to tell you that they are looking forward to perhaps eventually returning home. So this is an interesting issue that we've discovered, and that I think is a fundamental part of the immigrant experience that we really don't talk about much.
No, among many other things. I want to now, if you don't mind, Marcelo, go to on page 98 in Children of Immigration. Over time, immigrant children develop a keen eye for discerning a place of race and color in the U.S. status hierarchy. A 9-year-old Dominican boy noted, "In the United States, life is good to you if you are pretty and if you are white. If your face looks white and you are not very dark, life is good." A 15-year-old Chinese girl shared this with us. I have many friends from Russia. They can fit in with the Americans well and easily participate in the society because their appearance is relatively similar to Americans. If they speak English without an accent, you can't tell that they are from another country. If others think you are American, they won't treat you differently. But Asians can be distinguished from the Americans very easily. I have a Chinese-American friend who was born here, but teachers always ask her, "Where are you from?" Immigrant children of color know that many in the dominant culture do not like them or welcome them. Psychologically, what do children do with this reception? Are these attitudes of the host culture internalized, denied, or resisted? Want to talk about that at all?
Well, what we, of course, spend a great deal of time on this, that is, in some ways, perhaps, one of the ways in which immigration today differs from the large-scale migration to the United States over the last 150 years. Up to 1965, Athena, over 80% of all immigrants to the United States were Europeans. Today, well over 80% of all immigrants are people of color originating in Latin America, the Caribbean Basin, Asia, smaller groups from Africa and the Middle East. So we have, for the first time, really a new dynamic in the flow of migrants to our country. Before, it was largely phenotypically white folk who came from different parts of the world, but really overwhelmingly from the European continent. These are the Irish, the Italians, the Eastern Europeans, the Greeks, the Czechs, the Poles that came in huge numbers to our country, really since the beginning of the right at the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars into the 1960s. Today we have a different story. We have immigrants who phenotypically look differently. You have large numbers of Latinos, you have large numbers of Asians, you have large numbers of Afro-Caribbeans who not only originate in different countries with different languages, which we always had. That was the story of the Italians, that was the story of the Greeks, that was the story of the Norwegians, that was the story of the Swedes, that was the story of the making of the American dream. That huge flow of European peasants that in a fundamental way made our country what it is today. Now we're facing a very, very different story. Large-scale immigration, the large-scale so-called new immigration, in a fundamental way coincided with the great struggles for civil rights in our country, where race, ethnicity, and color have come to play such a basic role in the making and remaking of our social categories. So immigrants 100 years ago would learn the language, would begin to dress like the mainstream, will gravitate towards the tastes and the habits and the sensibilities of majority Americans, and in two generations, essentially, they disappeared. They began passing, was the sociological term we used. You could choose, if you so wanted, to celebrate your Greek origins or your Irish origins or your Italian origins. But these were what one of my former colleagues at Harvard once called ethnic options. You had the power. You could decide when are you going to celebrate or foreground in your identity the fact that you are Irish American or Italian American or Polish American. Now, today, with huge numbers of people who look differently because of their phenotype, we essentially began a new conversation about American society. the most important issue for us was first to establish, are children aware of these racial categories? Do they make any meaning of the fact that because of their phenotype, they look racialized, and they look racialized in ways that make them different from the mainstream American society? And what we discovered, to a great deal of surprise, was that children, A, were keen observers. They were like little anthropologists studying their social context. And they could understand and they could identify a whole racialized hierarchy of who is the dominant group, who are the more marginal groups, who has the power, who is less likely to have power. And that was in itself a very interesting scientific finding from our study. The second interesting scientific finding from our study was that children made very keen meaning and sense of the general hostility in the mainstream population, particularly in the media, about the new arrivals, particularly people of color. The children talked about how their groups were often portrayed as more prone to crime, more prone to all kinds of, let's say, dystopic social behaviors.
Gangs,
crime, lack of work ethic, you name it. The children mentioned these stereotypes.
Lazy, so, dirty.
Exactly.
All these stereotypes, and then the very positive stereotype that goes with being Asian, that could be hard to live up to too. In school, a lot of teachers just immediately think if the student is Asian, well, this is going to be a real performer.
Yes, we devise Carola particularly worked on this concept, the idea of the social mirror. What is the mirror that a child sees in the social interactions she or he engages in? And what we discovered is that there's a positive social mirror where the mirror that is held to the child is really distorting, but in a positive way. The expectation is that some children are going to have no problems, they're going to do brilliantly in school, they're not going to get into gangs, and these expectations may or may not coincide with ethnic or social realities.
Right, with the facts.
With facts, exactly. So overall, there is the so-called model minority myth that Asians are hardworking, brilliant in school, high achievers. They're all going to end up at Stanford and at Harvard when they grow up. In fact, that is not the case. In fact, if you look at our Asian origin populations, we have a whole range of adaptations. There's a wonderful movie that just came out by Clint Eastwood called Gran Torino. I don't know if you saw that movie.
And what is it called again?
Gran Torino.
Uh-huh.
And in the movie, Eastwood presents, I think, very accurately the tremendous problems one subgroup of Asian Americans, the Hmong people of Laos and Cambodia that came in large numbers after the end of the Vietnam War, are having in our cities, in Northern California, in Louisiana, in many other parts of the United States. So here you have an Asian group that, in a way, defies these expectations of the so-called model minority myth. They're Asian, yet the kids, particularly the boys, are having very serious difficulties in schools, very large problems with gang participation, and all kinds of other dysfunctions that we typically do not associate with the Asian model minority myth. So that's just an example of how the expectations that frame a social system negative effects in their eyes, in the experiences of immigrant children.
Yes, I understand. I know that when I lived, I grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah, which is, as you know, Utah is a Mormon state. And so when I was in elementary, there was a great deal of prejudice by many people, but there were those teachers who just were wonderful. But once I got into high school and college, there were teachers who were just like, oh, you're Greek, oh my word. And they were just, you know, it was just the total opposite. It was almost like, gee, if you're Greek, you must know all the philosophers and you must know, you know. And so it was, you know, that dichotomy, it was bizarre. But the prejudice, I will never forget it. And I will. And as a child, fourth grade, I think it was, we were doing the pageant, of course, a Christian pageant in a public school. And they wanted someone to sing O Little Town of Bethlehem. And my one teacher, who loved Mexico and Hawaii, she said, Athena's going to sing Little Town of Bethlehem. And my other fourth grade teacher said, no, because angels don't have black hair.
Oh, my.
and the other teacher said, but she's going to sing it. Athena is going to sing it. And she said, very well, but she will stand behind the screen. So I had to stand behind the screen to sing the song because angels do not have black hair. And so I suppose people could accuse me of having a chip on my shoulder, Marcelo. We're talking here with Marcelo Suarez-Orzoco, from New York University, and author, co-author with his wife Carola, of Children of Immigration. This is Education Now. It's 7:43. How do you feel about us opening up the lines to the?
And of course, we did open up the lines. We tried to anyway. And of course, it's 7:41 here at KZYX and Z. You're listening to Education Now with your host, Athena Melville, a pre-recording of our show on January 15th with Marcelo Suarez-Orzoco on the Children of Immigration. And we'll get back right now.
7117. If you'd like to talk or ask a question.
Remember, this was a pre-recorded show, so you're just hearing what was happening that evening. So here we go back now.
You know, it must be late there.
My pleasure. Yes, it's 10:45, but we have a very snowy day here. We had a big, big storm in New York. Actually, I'm out in Long Island today in Sag Harbor, and we've had a lot of snow, but it's very beautiful here.
Oh, it sounds beautiful, too. The weather here has been so bizarre. It's freezing cold at night, Marcelo, and then during the day it is so hot. It's like July.
Amazing.
Yeah, but there's no climate change. there was something that was very delightful in reading the book in the introduction about your children at the dinner table listening to you and Carola talk about all of these issues. Did they participate in the dialogue?
Oh, very much so. And they, of course, are very, very engaged and very interested in these issues. And they've traveled all over the world as we go and do either research or lecture. And they are keenly aware of the history of immigration and how central it is to the making of our country. And both Carola and I are immigrants. Carola is an immigrant from Switzerland. I was born in Latin America and migrated to Northern California when I was 17. I did all my studies in the Bay Area. Carola and I met very, very young, and we got married very, very young. And today, Athena, today is our 32nd anniversary. So,
oh, you were married on Martin Luther King's birthday.
Yes, that's correct. And so we are. This has been a family affair. This study of immigration, and it began when the two of us met as very young students at Berkeley.
Oh, that's so fantastic! How old are the children?
Our daughter is 25, and our son is 18.
Oh, that's so beautiful. I Do you homeschool? Is that how they can travel with you?
Well, no, we did actually homeschool our daughter for about a year in Cambridge, Massachusetts, after we moved from California to Cambridge. And then she went back to the school in Concord, Massachusetts. And our son is actually now in a wonderful school that is very much oriented towards the development of global consciousness and global citizenship, the Ross School in East Hampton, New York, which is an independent school with a focus on global issues and has cultural history at the center of the curriculum and the pedagogy. So they travel all over the world with the school. They were in New Orleans after Katrina to help build up. They were in China. They're going to, next month, they're going to Italy. So they travel all over the world studying different projects around the cultural history of civilizations and their interconnections.
It sounds fantastic. Now speaking, you know, you are our expert here. In public education, not just for immigrants, but for everyone, do you think that charter schools are a great solution?
Well, I think that they are an option. I believe that in a country as big as ours, as diverse as ours, I believe that the more of a buffet of options we have, so that parents can choose the specific ingredients of and combinations thereof for the education of their children, I think the better off we are. I don't think charter schools are the only solution. I certainly believe that there is a robust role in our cultural democracy for a vigorous public education system, but I also believe that parents have choice either to homeschool or to develop and insist upon the development of high quality, high accountability charter schools that serve their best interests. So when it comes to education, I'm a firm believer in a buffet of options. I'm a firm believer that what matters most is ultimately whether the children and the families become engaged with the educational institutions in their own communities. The most unfortunate finding of our research is the finding whereby over time, immigrant parents and immigrant children lose the optimism, the energy, the profound belief that they will have a better life in a new country. And a great deal of these loss in optimism has to do with the fact that they're encountering very mediocre schools, huge schools that are factories of despair, mausoleums, I think is the term you use.
Yes.
And these are the fastest way to kill the energy, to kill the optimism, to kill the faith in our democracy that our newest and littlest Americans bring with them. And that's a real tragedy. So the more options we have, the more engagement we have, the more we can make our schools be in sync with the realities of the 21st century, the better.
Yes, that was beautifully, beautifully put. Now, I want to be sure to mention, as well as Children of Immigration and this new book that you have written with Carola and Irini Todorova, Learning a New Land. Could you say her name for me?
It's Irina Todorova.
Todorova.
Beautiful. Yes.
Learning a New Land, Immigrant Students in American Society. There's that book, which is fabulous. And then Children of Immigration, and then Becoming Brazuca, Brazilian Immigration to the United States.
And those Corolla.
I think that's
Corolla.
Carola wrote, right. Carola wrote the introduction to that book, but it was edited by somebody else.
Uh-huh. And then you wrote Crossings, Mexican Immigration in Interdisciplinary Perspectives?
Yes, that's right.
As well as co-authoring this Children of Immigration and Passing Lines, Sexuality and Immigration.
Well, again, that's a book that was published by Harvard. It was edited by one of my colleagues, and I wrote the introduction to that book.
Uh-huh. Just wonderful, wonderful, wonderful work. I want to have you back. Do you suppose that's going to be possible?
Yeah, I'm sure we can arrange that.
All right, because there are many, many things that I am learning, and I feel that, especially here in California, well, I'm sure it's true everywhere, that this issue is not going to go away, and it's very important. And keeping the children in the center, if I could see big schools keeping each individual child in the center, caring about their individual growth, then I wouldn't be so critical. But I really do feel that with a smaller school and with a charter school and with the parents, empowering the parents, that child has, there's more hope that child and the way they learn will be kept in the center. I know there is a particular Montessori person who, in order to get the funding, registered every student as special ed. A special need. And
yes.
I thought that was extremely clever. And there are other people talking about seeing special education as another type of diversity. If the class sizes were small enough, you could really have a beautiful diversity. And you could, my idea is that a lot of these kids who speak such beautiful Spanish could be teaching. You know, they could be teaching the other kids and it would be very in a Montessori setting. I know that it would be totally possible, and what a wonderful gift that would be.
Yes, sure, it would be such an asset to the entire society to
yes.
have these immigrant languages actually thrive.
Yes, and it empowers the child.
It empowers the child. It empowers. It creates social good.
Yes.
Because the more languages we speak in
yes.
global economy and society of the 21st century, the better off we are as a society.
Yes.
So here you have a natural resource that comes with the linguistic stock of our immigrant origin population that, unfortunately, in too many cases in our history, has been lost.
That's right.
Greeks brought Greek to our country.
Yes.
The Italians brought Italians to our country. The Germans brought German to our country.
Yes.
The Japanese brought Japanese to our country. And as one of my colleagues at Harvard once said, our country is a cemetery for languages.
Yes, a cemetery for languages. That's what I meant about the disappearance of diversity.
Yes, and I think that is a real base that we no longer should tolerate in the context of an increasingly globally interdependent 21st century society.
I couldn't agree
all
with you.
All immigrants I know want their children to learn English, but it is also important that we nurture the cultural and particularly the linguistic talent these families bring with them, and we celebrate that as adding to the cultural stock of the nation.
Someone's calling us, Mark.
Of course, someone was trying to call us, and that was the night the transmitters were down, and we couldn't receive their phone call, so we deal with that for just a few moments in this pre-recording on Education Now from January 15th, and we're going to go back now.
Do with the transmitter, I don't know, but
oh
I'm
my.
Sure people will be sending me emails about it. It's time for us to say good night, unfortunately. Can I give out contact information?
Yes, it's, our website is Immigration Studies at New York University, and you can download research papers, you can see our television interviews, you can read more about our research in our website, immigrationstudies@nyu.edu.
Immigration Studies at NYU, what was the
dot
ref?
.edu.
.edu.
That's correct.
Oh, thank you so very much for being my guest tonight, Marcelo.
Thank you, Athena. My pleasure, and best of luck to you.
And good night, and thank you, and thanks to the whole family.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Good night.
Good night.
And there you have it. That was the interview with Marcel Suarez Orzoco from New York University. And I thank him so much for being my guest, and I thank all of you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it so much as I enjoyed bringing it to you. Education Now was brought to you tonight. Support for Education Now comes from our members and the producers of Education Now, the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. All programs aired on Education Now are available online for listening with download at their website or at our website, www.pacificsites.com/Tilda Hermes. And that Tilda is the one. Or you can just Google Melville Montessori School and it will come right up. And we thank them and our members for bringing us Education Now. In the future on Education Now, In March, which will be the third anniversary of Education Now, I'll be talking to you with all of the issues that have come from all of you during the time here on Education Now and the current issues in education. And that's will be our March show. And in the future, we're going to be focusing on art, on special education, and our annual media and education. So we're looking forward to that. I want to especially thank all of the staff here at KZYXNZ, especially Rich. He works so hard and teaches me so much. And my personal contact is hermes@pacific.net. I also want to alert you to an article on immigration from the Washington Post by Michael Falcone, F-A-L-C-O-N-E, published February 13th, 2009, about 2.2 million immigrants deported in the decade ended 2007. More than 100,000 were the parents of children who, having been born in the United States, were American citizens, according to this report issued Friday by the Department of Homeland Security. So you can check that out if you're interested. Also, for a model of the way that it's working for culture, race, diversity, Wendy Robinson, who is superintendent of Fort Wayne Community Schools in Fort Wayne, has a wonderful model that's been working there with these issues that Marcelo was speaking about tonight. I hope that you heard Democracy Now! Earlier this week, and Amy Goodman reported on the unprecedented cases of judicial corruption unfolding in Pennsylvania. Several hundred families have filed a class action lawsuit against two former judges who have pled guilty to taking bribes in return for placing youths in privately owned jails. You can check that out on Democracy Now! If you're interested and you didn't get to hear it. Well, I thank you all once again for listening. Coming up after Earth and Sky this evening will be W. Dan and the Treehouse, and you won't want to miss that. We all need a good laugh. And tomorrow, of course, at the Community Affairs, there'll be a program on at 9 in the morning. I'm not exactly sure whether it's the Access program or it's the Truth About Money, but you'll want to tune in then. And then tomorrow at 1 o'clock, there's always some good Community Affairs programming. As always, there's great music here on KZYXNZ. And I want to tell you about something else that's happening. So listen up for this. I do want to tell you about it just a moment here.
KZYXNZ hasn't done an auction in over a year, and this year we're hosting two, one online and one over the air. That's why we've partnered with Nevada Public Radio, another listener-supported station in Las Vegas, to host an incredible online auction. You'll have the chance to view and bid on items provided by other stations just like us, or you can decide to just view and bid on the KZYXNZ items. It's up to you. Preview of the items begins February 25th, and the auction on the web runs February 27th through March 7th. Visit kzyx.org for more information.
Well, you won't want to miss that auction. I'm sure it's going to be absolutely wonderful. And you're listening to KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits in Ukiah, K201 HR 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio, and we also stream live on the web at kzyx.org. Thank you very much for listening. This is Athena Melville with Education Now saying good night, and we're going to go to Earth and Sky. Good night, everyone.